Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to this live edition of Lunch with Loudon, brought to you by Coffee Party Radio and the marvels of the Internet. And this is Debbie Lynn Molyneau. I'm the normal co-pilot to Janine Loudon, who's on a well-deserved vacation today. So today's show, it's a healthy lunch with Loudon today as we talk about the politics and practice of food safety. And we're going to go local and grow local. We have, I don't know if you've noticed or not, but there's a movement or a shift among many areas of the country, among restaurants and grocery stores, and among us, the consumers, to source local, especially for our food. And the definition of local is to make sure that we get our food local. Our local can mean several hundred miles or across a region. But the idea is that we want to save energy and our environmental resources by not transporting our food across the world. So it sounds good, right? I mean, we're saving the planet after all. But for some folks, this also means that they now have a limited selection of products and to choose from and a limited selection of food. I was talking with a coffee party volunteer in Georgia yesterday who wants and needs to buy all organic products for her health. And the Whole Foods where she shops has adopted a policy of sourcing locally. And as a result of that, there's a increasingly limited number of organic produce that she can buy because there's simply things that aren't grown in her local area. And she simply cannot find any organic safflower oil. They just can't find it to carry it locally. So it's a simple, you know, economic formula. We've got supply and we've got demand. And we have the supply through the farming and distribution. We have the demand through consumption via stores and restaurants. So today, we're going to be talking with Chris Hardy of Village Farm in Jackson County, Oregon, who's actually concerned about his ability to farm and provide safe food for us to eat. And we'll also be talking with Mary McClausen of Wilsonville, Oregon, whose passionate drive to educate everyone to make healthy food choices drove a collaboration between the city of Wilsonville and a local high school to produce a community-wide sustainability event on local sourcing. So it's simple, really, right? We all want good food to eat. So Chris and Mary, I'm going to welcome you both to the show. And Chris, I'm going to start with you first. And tell us what's happening in Jackson County, Oregon, and why it's important to people in other parts of the country.
Well, it's local food is important. Sorry, your question again, you were breaking up there. I hope we have a good phone connection.
Yeah, well, I'm going to, so Chris, what I wanted to find out is if you could let us know what's happening in Jackson County, Oregon, and specifically with Village Farm, and why it's important to people in other parts of the country.
Why it's important to what?
Other parts of the country.
So what we're working on here in Jackson County, first off, Village Farm came pretty close to an interaction with multinational corporation Syngenta, who's home-based in Switzerland, who is presently growing GMO sugar beets for seed crops here in southern Oregon in the Rogue Valley. Village Farm was actually looking to lease a piece of land here in the Rogue Valley, and we spoke with the property owner, and come to find out, he was actually leasing to this Syngenta company to grow GMO sugar beets for seeds. And lo and behold, this sugar beet plot was actually within maybe a quarter of a mile from our farm. Two different plots, actually. One on one side of our farm, a quarter mile up the way, and one maybe at most a little better than a quarter of a mile. a little bit more research on the subject with Syngenta and USDA APHIS, who oversees the regulation and enforcement of the regulated crops that are, you know, so ubiquitously found in the Midwest with the corn and the soybeans, but also with the sugar beets here in the Rogue Valley. That basically Syngenta was to mine a 4-mile isolation distance as they were regulated at that time. They presently, as of July 19th, are no longer regulated. So they were deregulated, that is to say. But at the time, at least for the 4 years that Village Farm had been producing beet and chard seed on our farm, we understood at that window of time that Syngenta had been there for that window, also growing seeds for seed crops and for a couple of years at least genetically engineered sugar beets were being grown. So that was quite a shocker to us, and that basically was the start of an effort to ban cultivation of the genetically modified crops here in the Rogue Valley, and that's what we've been up to here for a number of months since the discovery of the sugar beet production here.
So let me get this straight. So basically, this multinational corporation came into Jackson County, and instead of outright buying the land, they went to local landowners, leased the land, which is a private contract, so there's no public records for anybody to find out about it, and started growing GMO seed plants within a 4-mile buffer zone that was the current regulation, although it no longer is, and breaking the law. And nobody knew about it until you went and tried to lease the same land.
Until we went and tried to lease the same land. And I don't know if they, you know, BRS, Biotech Regulatory Service, who is a division of the USDA APHIS, Animal Plant Health Inspection Services, they actually sent out a couple investigators from BRS in Washington, D.C., to investigate the potential that Syngenta had breached the 4-mile isolation per regulated crop with the sugar beet is 4-mile isolation. And there have been a number of incidences that came to light over the past several months where other organic and non-organic chard and beet growers have found out that Syngenta, you know, also like Village Farm found out that Syngenta was just around the corner from them planting genetically engineered sugar beets. So that's why BRS from D.C. sent out these investigators. And that case is ongoing right now, and hopefully we will have word back from BRS within the next month or so what the outcome of the finding was.
Wow. So we don't have the actual findings yet, but you think that they were within the 4-mile buffer zone. It seems pretty obvious.
It does seem pretty obvious. It also seems, though, the due diligence process that's required under APHIS is a very gray area, and that there is no clear way to enforce this. According to Syngenta, Southern Oregon manager, he had contacted OSU Extension, asked them where the seed growers or the organic farmers are in the Rogue Valley, and a couple farms' names were thrown out there, I guess, and nothing of Village Farm or the multitude of other farms that I know that have been directly impacted were mentioned to this Southern Oregon manager. And so the years went on, and lo and behold, we've been right next door to Syngenta the whole time.
Wow. And Syngenta, just can you give us like a lowdown? Because I know everybody focuses on Monsanto as being the big bad GMO people, and we might want to back up a minute and actually explain what a GMO is in case anybody's listening today who doesn't know what a GMO is.
Yeah, well, a definition that our team, GMO Free Jackson County, has pulled together as to what a GMO is. Basically, genetically engineered plants, and we pulled these definitions together from you know, technical literature and other resources. You know, I believe we even used the USDA's website to pull some of these definitions together. But basically, it's a plant whose genetic material has been altered using genetically engineered techniques. These techniques generally are known as recombinant DNA technology. Use DNA molecules from different sources, which are combined into one molecule to create a new set of genes. This DNA is then transferred into an organism, giving it modified or novel genes. Transgenic organisms, that is GMO or GE organisms, have different organisms' genetics or DNA inserted from different species into that plant or animal.
So, Chris, is there scientific proof that the GMOs are actually harmful to humans, or is it a big unknown?
Boy, you know, me personally, I'm not a scientist. I like to claim myself a scientist because I dig in the earth and spend a lot of time with plants and insects. But I think that there is a lot of concern in the medical community right now about, you know, what is happening to... But it's the long term that no one has really looked at, Debbie Lynn. That's really important to understand, that we do not have enough research that is looking at the longer term problems. You know, there are studies that were just performed here recently where the pregnant women were at in Canada, and the findings, the research were that 94% of the women that were tested had a BT bacillus thuringiensis pesticide, which is one of the common GMO corn products that are on the market.
Mm-hmm.
He was found in 94% of women's serum blood levels, and then 80% of the umbilical cords came up positive for this BT pesticide. So contrary to what Monsanto was saying, how this BT breaks down in the gut and it does not transfer onward into human beings, appears to have some there's some understanding that that's not really the case.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, in some of the research I did, you know, just in prepping for the show, it looked like, you know, I mean, there's worldwide, there are so many countries that have just outright banned GMOs, and our country won't even allow us to label GMO foods, or doesn't require it. It's not that we can't label it, but, you know, nobody's going to label it unless it's required. It sounds like there's just, like it's not proven to be safe, but it's not proven to be harmful yet, because there hasn't been enough time elapsed. But yet we have, isn't there like a huge percentage of some of our crops that are GMOs, just because, I mean, it spreads so rampantly once it gets started?
Well, it's pretty difficult, first off, to even get a genetically modified genetic out of your plants and out of your seeds once it's in there. So I think it's important to understand that you don't just you basically would have to destroy your seed your seeds in order to get rid of the say it's a Roundup Ready or a Bacillus thuringiensis or fish genetics in your tomatoes, whatever. You'd have to destroy these seeds. This isn't something you would just breed out of them. Possibly you could take it back to the laboratory, but, you know, what farmer wants to have to call up a lab to be able to have their seeds worked on? Seeds have been worked in the field, in nature, in communities to develop these seeds for tens of thousands of years. Like, why do we need to rely on a scientist in a laboratory to develop our food, the foundation of our food supply?
Now, Chris, I'm a little bit familiar with ag terms because I just moved to Oregon a couple of years ago from the Central Valley of California, where we have tons of farmers. So when you say Roundup Ready and a couple of other things, I actually know what you mean. But for the sake of people who aren't familiar with farm talk, can you explain Roundup Ready and the other two ones that you threw out there? Because those are farm-specific terms. So for us non-farmers, can you tell us what those are?
Yes. So Roundup Ready is also known as Roundup Resistant. It's more probably appropriately named Roundup Resistant because you basically, the whole idea is that you can spray the chemical on to your field without damaging the crop, and in the meantime, it's killing the weeds. That's what Roundup is. Mm-hmm. Roundup.
This is a GMO plant that is already herbicide resistant.
These plants are genetically created in the laboratory, genetically modified such that they can withstand dosages of herbicides. And
mm-hmm.
these chemicals are sprayed on the crop, directly on the foliage, directly on the fruit, directly on whatever it is. You know, in the case of the sugar beets, you know, it's sprayed on the whole doggone thing and the soil and the whole lot to kill the weeds that are coming up in between the rows so that the crop is then able to push on up and not have a problem with the competition of the weeds. Essentially, this it makes sense if you're into new and fun and really interesting scientific discoveries and such, but the facts are that convenience with the cost, and the cost perhaps is that these chemicals are becoming the weeds that are getting sprayed with these chemicals are becoming resistant, and they now have millions of acres across the globe that are resistant. Strains of weeds are popping up all over the place, so they're having to add more chemicals, something to the tune of a half a billion tons of chemicals have been an increase by that much, by a half a billion.
Yeah.
No, I need to get back straight here. It could be half a billion pounds, but I know it's 500 million pounds or 500 million tons. It's probably pounds of chemical increases have been seen over the past several years because of the resistance that's popping up within the populations of our weeds.
Yeah, so instead of actually having, you know, so if GMOs are supposed to reduce pesticides, they're actually having an opposite impact. So not only do the plants themselves then have the chance of having an herbicide included in the food that we're eating inside of it instead of on the outside where we can wash it off, but then it's actually taking more herbicide to kill the weeds along with their invasive in the crops themselves. So it's actually like counterproductive to everything we're trying to do.
Indeed it is, and it's somewhat disconcerting to understand that they are at present trialing 2,4-D versions of corn and beans and many other crops to kind of head this one off at the pass to be able to basically come up with cocktails of interesting genetic and chemical variations to be able to fight this these weeds that are becoming more resistant to the Roundup, the glyphosate that's been used for a couple of decades now, roughly. That now there's such prevalency with resistance that they're actually the chemical resistance that they're having to get stronger chemicals. And 2,4-D is one of the constituents to the Agent Orange that they use back in Vietnam. It's about 50%
of
the formula.
And we know how awful that is. Chris, I'm going to have one more question here that just came in on our chat room, and then I'm going to shift the conversation over to bring Mary in so that we can talk about a little bit of the demand side and the growing demand that we have for safe food. So here's the question that came in on the chat room. Is it true that if a ground grew GMO foods, it can never grow certified organic foods?
Supposedly, the USDA has looked at the numbers. Supposedly, 3 years is the half-life of Roundup. Roundup, again, is the ubiquitous chemical that you find in the biotech and even in conventional industries, and you find it on the shelves of your local farm implement, your farm product store, and you can use it on your lawn to get rid of the dandelion. Glyphosate, they say, is a 3-year half-life, which means that in 3 years' time, it supposedly breaks down enough to where there's not even trace amounts, negligible amounts of this found in the soils. So then you could call up, say, an organic certifier and get your land certified if you knew that for 3 years that the chemical, any herbicides, pesticides, or any other prohibited substances had not been used on your land, on your soil.
Okay. So it takes at least three years.
At least 3 years, yep.
Great. Well, I'm going to bring Mary into the conversation now and talk a little bit about the demand side, Chris. So if you can hang on, we'll come back to you and turn this into a 3-way conversation. And Mary built a collaborative effort here in Wilsonville, Oregon, between the city of Wilsonville and the Arts and Technology High School to host it's called the Down to Earth Sustainability Speaker Series, which were 3 forums on sustainable food and healthy food choices. So, Mary, welcome.
Thank you, Debbie Lynn.
Yeah. And can you just tell us a little bit about what you saw in the community that led to this collaboration?
I think what I see in Wilsonville is just a microcosm of what is in a lot of communities across the country, and that is the proliferation of fast food restaurants. There's just a homogeneous look to every city where they have all their fast food restaurants, all that kind of thing, and people are, the mainstream population is not aware of what is happening with things that relate to our local sustainable food supply, such as a dwindling number of family farms in America due to corporate agriculture, and, of course, the economy and how difficult it is for small farmers to get loans and things like that. So there's that issue. And there's just, it's all about access. The problems in our communities are about access to local sustainable food. Now, here in Oregon, we tend to have a more advanced infrastructure in place, you know, in terms of community CSAs and farmers markets and health food stores, all those kinds of things. But still, there is a really large segment of the population that doesn't understand how their food choices are affecting their health and are affecting the local business communities where they live. So the local cafe who may buy all of his cafe owner who buy or restaurateur may like to locally source his produce or her dairy or things like that. If people don't support those businesses and those local farms and those local farmers markets, it not only affects their health, it affects the economy. So it was all about raising awareness. You know, people like, there's a certain segment of the population that gets it. We get what the impact is through years of study on, you know, what's going on with the GMOs, like Chris was talking about. You know, the very fact that I've heard that Walmart is not even labeling its sweet corn as GMO laced sweet corn is, you know, it's just abominable. You know, so we have to, it's all about a grassroots effort. And for me, it started with, okay, what can I do in my own backyard? If we, and as you know, I know you support that, everybody doing what they can. I took a course in the spring of 2011 offered in Portland, Oregon by an organization called the Center for Earth Leadership. And I believe their website is earthleaders.org. And it's a free 6-week course on how to be an agent of change in your community related to the sustainability movement. So it's any type of sustainability. And the founders of the group saw that they understand how change occurs in our society. It has to take root at the grassroots level. So I took this course with a lot of other advocates for sustainability, and the only requirement was that we come out of it with a commitment to doing something for sustainability in our communities. So I was already volunteering at a local alternative high school, which is part of the big Westland-Wilsonville school district, and I have a background in marketing and public relations as well as an interest in health and wellness. So I approached the principal and said, what are your goals? Let's collaborate. Her goals were community outreach and fundraising and engaging her students, high school students, in healthier lifestyles. As we know, the obesity problem, so many students, the young adults are being targeted by the billion-dollar fast food industry, and her students were no exception. It was not unusual at all at lunch hour for all the kids to make a mass exodus over to Taco Bell, Wendy's, McDonald's. There were probably 10 choices within two blocks of the school. And so that was important to her as well, to make it a curriculum-based issue. So we decided to do a sustainability speaker series. I told her, well, that's a way to get the community into your school auditorium. It's a way for you to raise awareness about what your school's doing and your students, because a lot of people don't understand the concept of an alternative high school. And so I said, but to make this truly successful, we have to engage the city of Wilsonville. We need their buy-in. We need their promotional engine through their website, their newsletter that goes to all the residents. So we met with the community outreach manager for the city, and they have a part-time sustainability manager, and said, what do you feel? Do you want to be interested or to be involved? And they said, yes, but through their surveys that they did to the community, they said, Mary, we encourage you to do food or water. If you want to reach the mainstream citizens of this area, those are the key issues. And in fact, in surveys, it came out time and time again that local sustainable food was important to the citizens, so much so that every year when they put out the community garden plots, there's an overwhelming response and, you know, they can't fulfill all the requests. So the city got behind it. They weren't, in these tight budget times, they weren't able to put a lot of money into it, but they did put staff time in to support the promotional effort for it. So we launched the series in late January, and I can go into more detail. I don't, you know, you may have some follow-up questions at this point. So, but it was a three-part series.
Yeah, well, and I love the program schedule that Mary had sent over to me. By the way, for those of you who are listening online, I put a link in on the chat room for the Agent of Change leadership program that Mary mentioned earlier, so you can catch that online on the chat room. The program schedule that Mary put together, they talked first about the sustainable food supply benefiting the local community. And then you went really personal with actually talking about like cooking and gardening.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
To really bring it into the home.
Again, it was all about making this relevant for the average citizen of the area. You know, we can have all these talks, which, and Chris, believe me, we integrated the GMO issue into our discussions. You know, but if we'd have called it GMOs, you know, for the mainstream, it probably wouldn't have drawn the crowd. So instead, we said, our first event was a panel discussion featuring a very innovative farmers market manager, which I'd like to tell you more about what she's doing to engage children in working kind of Jamie Oliver style in getting young kids to care about their food. And so we did a panel discussion with Jackie Hammond-Williams, the farmers market manager at the Oregon City Farmers Market. It's an award-winning farmers market. I had an organic farmer, Scott Frost. He has an organic farm in Albany. And then I also had a corporate sustainable food producer, Pacific Natural Foods out of Tualatin, Oregon. They make all the soups, broths, mates, teas, all organic. And not only do they promote sustainable foods, but their whole corporate culture is one of sustainability. So it was a really powerful first panel for giving the local citizens an overview of what's going on in their own backyards in the availability and offerings, why it's important to pay attention to the needs of an organic farmer, why it's important to really support local farmers markets and CSAs, and what local manufacturers are doing. You know, this was a 300-employee company, Pacific Natural Foods, so it was really helping the economic base of the area as well as totally supporting. I mean, their products are available throughout the United States. So that laid the groundwork for the average citizen without a lot of information on sustainable food. So that was the first event in January. About 7 weeks later, we went from that level down to, okay, we've explained sustainable food. How can you integrate it into your daily life through cooking? So encouraging, and of course, knowing that I had to have a marketing flair to get the people in the seats, I booked an award-winning chef in Portland, Pascal Chereau, who I knew, and I knew he, of course, adhered to a lot of local sustainable food, as most award-winning chefs do. They want locally sourced food. So I approached him about coming in and talking about his cooking philosophy and about using local greens, and he was wonderful. He did a cooking demo, and of course, that drew people, because we know the mainstream population really follows a lot of cooking shows. And he's a very likable person, a lot of personality. He did a cooking demonstration, but he passed around the audience members just picked fresh organic greens. And you could just see the faces light up on the audience when they smelled what it's like to truly be in front of a very healthy, maybe 8-hour-old greens from a garden. And it was just very incredible for them to see that versus the salads in a bag. So
this is lunchtime, you know, out here on the West Coast. This is lunchtime. You're making me hungry, Mary.
Oh, sorry. Okay. I understand. So anyway, he did this amazing cooking demonstration, really encouraging people to eat more healthfully. And then I also brought in a nutritionist, and she talked about, you know, she even showed a slide of a McDonald's Big Mac. I think it was 200 days old, and how it looked 200 days old. And so images like that stick with people. You know, so we tried to keep it very, not simple, but, you know, something people could relate to really stress, you know, why they need to think more about what they're picking up at the grocery store. So that was our second event, and that was very well received. And we had a couple of organic farmers in the audience, and so they were there to answer questions. Then our third event in May was taking it the next step, which was taking it into your own backyard, putting in your own garden. So teaching people about permaculture and what it means to eat food in season versus what it takes to eat a pineapple in December, you know, and all the economic sustainable issues that come up with that. So again, educating people. And so I had a master gardener come in who was just amazing, and an organic farmer who brought in samples of different types of soil. His talk was called The Magic of Living Soil. And again, turning people on through demonstration, having them look at the soil of something. He actually had soil from a conventional farm that had herbicide sprayed all over it. And the soil was dry, light brown, crumbly. Then he had them look at soil from an organic farm, and the richness and the smell and the texture, and passing these bowls around the audience was really powerful to get people to understand this is living soil. This is the source. And so it was just magical to see the lights turn on, not only in the public, but in the students that were helping out with these events.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, well, and I'm going to bring Chris back here in just a second, because I'm sensing some synchronicity here about, you know, Chris is coming in and approaching this from a very scientific basis, and you're coming in and approaching this from very much of an engage the public at a place where they live, which is not necessarily
right
from the science, even though we need to connect it to the science.
Yes.
And so, Chris, I just opened up your mic again. But I'm, you know, especially this last demonstration that you're talking about, I'm wondering if there isn't some way where we can do, in order to engage the public to really care about this, to care that there's these GMO seeds that are, in, you know, basically infecting or destroying our seed basis, and all of our, you know, the basis from which all of our future crops are coming.
Can I add one thing about what Chris was saying? I want people to really understand that this is not only about modifying our food supply, but it's the end game here with Monsanto and these other companies is controlling our food supply and the implications of that. And I'd like Chris to talk about that if he'd like to, that this is what I want the public to understand. This is about worldwide control of our food supply.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting that you know, most people would have thought corn and beans and you know, cotton and wheat and rice, and you know, they're growing the multitudes of the billions of acres that they grow around the planet on big, large scale monocrops. But come to find out, right here in our Rogue Valley, southern Oregon, we have little quarter acre plots, 1 acre, 2 acres, 4 acres. Growing GMO sugar beets for seed. This is enough to pretty much kibosh any local food system that cares about not having genetic contamination, transgenic crops in their food supply. But you'd never know it. You know, it's just these tiny little plots that are being grown. And so contrary to what most of us understand, you know, what big ag looks like, it's very much just leasing little chunks of ground all over the Rogue Valley here,
mm-hmm.
we found out. And, you know, they maybe just have a one-year lease, maybe multiple-year lease, but they are able to bring in, you know, their chemical fertilizers, and they really don't have that connection with the land where they're building their soil fertility for long-term connection with their land. It's just kind of more the same of what the big ag would be doing, but it's more stealthy nature, and just because no one really, like we in our farm and at least another dozen farms in the Rogue Valley did not know that they were right next door to the seed crops, that they were also eating the seed crops.
Well, and they're being very strategic. Go ahead.
Well, and here's another point that I want to bring in, and this has come up on the chat room over here too, is that are there, and Chris, I want to ask this question directly of you, are there new regulations that are coming in that are being sponsored by or directed towards big ag that are impacting you that make it more difficult for you to farm?
New rules?
Yeah, new regulations that you have to follow that make it more difficult for a small farm to operate.
I wouldn't say specifically. I know some of the larger organic farms here in the Rogue Valley, which are still pretty small compared to, you know, the bigger ones across the country, are having to, you know, go through this process, like they're basically trying to get everybody on board with the bigger food system agenda, which is in the name of food safety. And you know, for instance, if you find like a little squirrel in your field, you have to basically destroy, like I believe it's a 50-foot radius, you know, around that is to say 100 foot long, which, you know, some of our beds we do plantings of 100 foot in length. And so that would, you know, we'd have to destroy a whole crop if we so much as saw a squirrel in our field. It's like, well, wait, we have squirrels and occasionally rabbits. These things are just, they're part of nature and they get into our fields, you know, that's nothing really we can do about that. And if we were to follow the rules that the big guys have to play by, then we're basically going to not really just be able to stay competitive unless we're to just eradicate every creature in the whole entire area.
Right.
So as far as other rules that we have to follow by, I can't say that it's, you know, the biggest, toughest challenges for us are, you know, not knowing where our seeds, you know, how to keep our seeds pure. And, you know, they're allowing a little bit of trace amounts of contamination. The USDA National Organic Program now allows trace amounts of genetic, transgenic pollens, genetic DNA in the seed. You know, even if you had your seed tested, you could find that there's trace bits of GMO in your seed. That's now acceptable. That's common practice for the USDA, who basically certifies or is the parent agency for the 100 or so certifiers across the country. And they're now saying it's okay to have a little bit of GMO in your seed stock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and who asked me?
Yeah, we've got to have more gatekeepers and activism. I was doing some research with my friend Scott Frost, and there's a National Organic Food Association. I can't think of the name right now. But we went to their website. We were directed there by a documentary that just came out, kind of pointing out how the big corporate food producers are infiltrating the organic food standards organizations. So you've got the big ConAgra and Smucker's Foods and all these other huge producers of food infiltrating. They're sitting on the board now of this National Organic Foods Association and changing slowly and not so slowly, changing the rules and regulations of what's allowed in the organic food supply. So we all have to be aware of how insidious and stealth-like they're being, and it requires activism. So, I'm reminded of the pink slime movement of a few months ago, the whole thing related to the pink slime and meat, and how quickly through social media and engaging the grassroots mothers, mostly, of America, getting things changed. And that's why understanding how change occurs in our society and in our culture, to engage, you know, the citizenry to at a level they can understand, and then boom, start getting the social media, et cetera, out there with talking points on specific things. Pink slime was something everybody could wrap their heads around. And if we could find a way to get that message out there with GMOs and these other related issues, we can make this a part of the mainstream consciousness. Yet that's the thing that will make the government, the everybody else start paying attention, but it's got to happen at that level.
Yeah, I love the way you think, Mary. This is why you're such a PR professional. And if we could get a pink slime type movement going on to protect organics and protect our food supply, I think that would be great. There's some comments going on over here on the chat room that I just want to pay attention to, or at least bring up since we're having this conversation. And that is, there's a Senate bill going on nationally, and I just want to see if either of you know about it yet. I guess it's Senate Bill F-10, the Food Safety Modernization Act. Do either of you, that would put, it says, one of our listeners says it would put the U.S. food and U.S. farms under the Homeland Security and Department of Defense in the event of contamination.
Mm-hmm.
Do either of you know anything about that?
I am familiar with it. I have heard of it. A couple of friends were talking to me about it, but I don't know in depth. So I really applaud the listeners for bringing that out. That's great. Chris, how about you?
Yeah, I'm not so familiar with that that bill. I know they're working on a lot of different levels to so-called protect our foods and protect our health and safety. But the reality is that these are the same people that are telling us. This is the USDA APHIS, who's telling us, and the Farm Bureau, and everybody's using this line that they have a four-mile regulation. The USDA came up with four-mile isolation distance for the GMO sugar beet, and here they are growing it in southern Oregon. And we have dozens. We have close to 100 farms that I personally spoke with who had no clue that Syngenta was just down the street from their farms, within, say, quarter of a mile away from their farms. Well, they are saving seeds themselves, and so, you know, to believe that Syngenta, that the USDA, if it's, how do they enforce it? Again, the devil's
right
in the details here, and I really do not see that the due diligence is even traceable. I was on a conference call with the director of the Biotech Regulatory Service, BRS, here a few days ago, and they could not answer my questions. They said, well, you're going to have to write that all down in a... I'm like, this is a simple question that I have for you folks, and if it is, how do you ensure that Syngenta has been paying attention to the requirement of a four-mile isolation distance? And they could not answer that simple question.
So
I think the regulations are just, the regulations are, it's all just a very gray area. And in practice,
mm-hmm.
half this stuff with our health and our safety and all that, it gets to a point where it's so big, none of this stuff is really going to make our food any safer, but they want to think it's going to make it safer because they're passing laws to make it all safe.
They're passing laws to make what they're doing illegally now legal, so that then we feel safe because it's legal, but that's not to say that it's safe. It's not the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, where does your local Farm Bureau stand on all of this? Because it seems to me like they should be some of the biggest advocates for getting Syngenta called to the carpet.
Yeah, our local Farm Bureau, if you search their website backwards and forwards, as our team has, because we're interested to hear what the Farm Bureau has to say on this issue, they really have not a resource on their website or connections, from what I understand, with any organic farmers. So I don't understand how they can be so passionate about biotechnology, I'm just curious to like how they're able to understand how where organic industry is coming from, how seed savers are coming from, because biotech isn't about seed savers. You're not a seed saver if you're into Monsanto Roundup Ready corn. You just
right.
simply order more of it from Monsanto when you run out.
So your Farm Bureau is not supportive of what's going on. So what are your next steps? Where are you finding support in your local community?
Our local community, our school gardens, our community gardens, and our regional farms. We GMO Free Jackson County actually has over 100. Supporters of businesses and farmers alike, and dozens of farms have stepped forward to show their support and stand behind and improve as a business and as a farm that we ban GMOs in Jackson County. And this is what we are sharing presently with the county commissioners, are well aware that we have this outpouring in community support behind us of nonprofits and businesses and farms, more than 100 in county.
Mm-hmm. So just real quick, out to you, we've got just a few minutes left here. Yeah, so we've got, so Coffee Party Radio goes, you know, nationwide. We've got people across the country listening today. What can we do to help get word out for you?
Well, I think that it's important to understand that we all need to know what's in our food. Clearly, what the American Medical Association and the American Dietetics Association, the Food and Drug Administration, the USDA, you know, where are they getting their numbers from? I think we should all be questioning every step of the way as to what these guys have been putting out is safe and acceptable for our food, for our farmers. And I really think that everyone should ask their supplier of their food, their grocery store managers, and get involved in their local communities around food, but we should need, at the very least, to have our food labeled, even if it is imported, or if it comes locally, we should be very curious as to how our food is created and ask our government to label the food clearly as such.
Yep. Not only ask, yeah, but demand it. It's required, and so I support you in that. It's really the politics of food, just like the politics of healthcare. If I can add that, I know someone who works for the agricultural school at Oregon State University. He's very highly placed there, and yet there's so many aspects of this. It's just follow the money. It's the corporate food industry has the lobbyists. They also donate millions and billions of dollars to the agricultural universities around the country, like Oregon State, to fund the research there. So who do you think the researchers and scientists are going to support in their data? It's going to be, you know, the big ag, and that the GMO issue, it's not what everybody's saying it is. Or we really don't need small family farms anymore, is basically what this one person said to me on the faculty at Oregon State. How can we feed the entire population just on family farms, you know, with his, you know, write-off? So we have to understand all the different aspects of society that are being controlled and bust through that with, you know, the grassroots people demanding to know what's in their food and demanding that it be quality.
Indeed.
Yes. Thanks, Mary. I was just about to say that. So thank you. Well, and Chris, you know, whatever you need to do to follow the money trail, you know, in Jackson County, to find out where your money trail leads from in the Farm Bureau. And Chris, I had to put you on mute. We had some background noise there. But why the, you know, where's, you know, is the Farm Bureau being funded by Syngenta? And what about your county commissioners? Because I'm assuming that, you know, you don't have support right now for getting GMOs banned in Jackson County. So, you know, whatever help can be had in following the money trail there. Mary, just one last question for you before we start closing out the show today. And that is, you know, all this talk about food has really made me hungry for lunch. And I really want to know, like, what was, like, your favorite secret from the chef?
Oh, my favorite feature from the chef? Is that what you said?
Secret. You had secrets from the chef.
Oh, secrets from the chef. Oh, gosh. He talked about, it's in the simplicity. So many people in the audience wanted to know, you know, how he made his little salads and things so flavorful, and they were expecting him to, you know, list off all these amazing ingredients that he used in his spice mixes. And he was able to say, if you have really fresh greens, you know, and really hold that as a priority, he said, I add a little garlic, a little salt, you saute it in olive oil. It's the simplicity. We all think it has to be this complex mixture of things, but if you're working with pure ingredients, the taste is there. You know, it's not rocket science. You know, it's not a need for preservatives. And he even joked that his wife, who's a lawyer, often tries to help him at home, and she'll go to stores and buy the big plastic bags of salad, and he's slowly changing her and saying, honey, you're really not helping me here. Smell the difference between the gas that comes out of this bag, you know, versus what I just got from the local gardener, you know. And obviously you can't get always fresh greens year round, but just that reinforcing that it's the simplicity of food. The flavor is there. It doesn't have to be managed or enhanced. It's there in its natural state. And so the light bulbs were going off, and I would say that's one secret. And it doesn't take a lot of finesse. You know, he quickly sauteed some things. He put it with a really neat pastry with mushrooms and things, and it was just amazing in its complex flavors. So, you know, just hearing it from him that any of us can do it. And that's what I wanted the audience to get, that you don't have to be a revered French chef to do this. You know, it's accessible to all of us. And don't just open up the box of Hamburger Helper, you know, for convenience. Within 10 minutes, or if not sooner, you can saute some amazing vegetables and have an incredible dinner for your family.
One other thing I
want to add before I run out of time is the series that we did here in Wilsonville, it's a template and it can be improved upon, but there's a basic template that is usable for any community and a way for it to relate to local governments and to get the school district buy-in, those core organizations, and just to start laying it out and getting it out there.
And how would people get that template from you, Mary?
Well, they can email me at maryclausson@msn.com. That's maryclausson@msn.com. Now, I want to reinforce that I did this as a voluntary effort. And, you know, right now I can't afford to do that another year. So I'm going to look into grants from the county and from other sources to help pay for my time to do it, you know, the next year. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, I can't afford to just donate it every year. But that's not to say in other communities there aren't people who can volunteer and do it, or there are ways to get money to support people who want to work in this area.
Great. Well, Mary, I thanks so much for that. And I put that on the chat room so people can have your email there.
Great.
And we are just about out of time, so I am going to just remind everybody that, and well, thank you, first of all, Chris and Mary, for being our guests today. You're wonderful to spend some time with us and talk about food safety and what's happening, not only here, but I just, when I heard the story about Jackson County, Oregon, and what's happening with Syngenta Farms, I just wondered how many other local counties across the country is this happening to? Because I'm betting it's happening everywhere. So, everyone who's out there listening, you might just take, you know, talk to your local farmer and find out how many seed farms are being leased by Syngenta or Monsanto or any of the other big farmers, and find out what's happening in your local area and how our food supply is being tainted. So thank you again for that. So this has been the Healthy Lunch with Loudon. As we make do without Janine, she'll be back next week. And please remember that Coffee Party Radio is 100% member supported, and we appreciate every single contribution from the annual memberships like me or the monthly sustaining memberships like Janine does. So if you are able, please go to coffeepartyusa.com and become a member, renew your membership, or simply donate today. And thank you. And in the spirit of Janine, Coffee Party on.